7FM KPFK. You're listening to 90.7 FM, KPFK Los Angeles.
Sí se puede. The Vietnamese never froze my wages. Fight fascism. When history cannot be written with a pen, it must be written with a gun.
The 60s gave birth to some great political iconography, great political rhetoric. I think of the peace sign, the image of Che, the black power fist. These images are still in circulation. They evoke embarrassment in some and nostalgia in others. Welcome to Deadline LA. I'm Barbara Osborne. You know, after 9/11, progressives diagnosed a kind of hole in contemporary American political iconography. You could wave a flag to say, I love this country, 9/11 was awful. But in doing so, you risked evoking jingoism. And it was a real dilemma for progressives. Today, I'm joined by a couple of people who have been thinking a lot about progressive political iconography and rhetoric, past and present. They're all involved in an exhibit that opens at LA Contemporary Exhibitions in Hollywood this Saturday, May 4. I'm joined now by Tuna O'Nielsen. She's the co-curator of Democracy When, Activists Strategizing in Los Angeles. I'm also joined by Julia Meltzer and David Thorne. They are the coordinators of the Speculative Archive for Historical Clarification, artists who have work in the exhibit. Their piece involved looking at many of the hallowed icons of 60s political imagery and evaluating their meaning for audiences today. The audio that you hear now is part of their exhibit. Thank you both very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Julia and David, let me throw you the first question. You've been doing research at the Center for the Study of Political Graphics, and I wondered if you would talk a bit about the kind of imagery that you've been going through.
The type of images that we've looked at, the collection has 45,000 posters from the Russian Revolution to the present, and they're from all over the world, from North, Central, South America, the Caribbean, Africa, Asia, Australia, Europe, and the Middle East. So we actually looked at a smaller section of that collection, 1,000 images, of sort of the most well-known images, and we combed through the archive looking for tropes in...
Tropes, what do you mean?
Categories that consistently get reused in political imagery. Like the work... Go ahead, David.
Yeah, David.
Recurring modes of representation, recurring strategies, recurring icons, recurring kinds of images.
So, David, could you tell us what kind of recurring images you found within that body of political graphics?
After going through these images a number of times, again, we went through the ones that are the most accessible and the most handleable for the general public that are part of the collection, that aren't sort of things that you have to handle with kid gloves. And we sort of started breaking things down into a number of categories of different positions that kept coming up. And they're sort of the classic positions, let's say, of the worker or of the rebel or of the oppressor or of the victim,
the people.
Citizen, the people. These are kind of the meta figures that, you know, are represented over and over again in different ways and sometimes in the same way over a long period of time.
And across different struggles.
Mm-hmm. So these were the kinds of images that we were looking at, and then we started to think about how these categories kind of are represented across these images.
And are the two of you able to make certain generalizations about, say, how the oppressor or how the people are represented? Are there generalizations to be made about how those categories are represented in progressive political iconography?
Well, you know, the oppressor often involves a bloody claw, an iron fist, an evil-looking white male politician, and often sort of well-known political figures on who were vilified on the left, like Nixon, Lyndon B. Johnson.
So with figures like that, I mean, part of what became interesting to us over the course of looking at the materials and also doing some reading and discussing was, for instance, with sort of top-level government officials, let's say, and the way that they're vilified, sometimes and oftentimes rightly so. What became interesting to us was the way in which they were vilified and thinking about how in that process maybe there was actually some sort of limitation being generated in terms of how one could think about oppression. Because by channeling everything into this individual figure, like putting it all onto one person, let's say, like it's Nixon, you know, Nixon is evil. You know, what does that limit in terms of the way we think about how power functions?
Or how and how we can react, how we are positioned in relation to that power.
I assume what you, Julia Meltzer, and David Thorne are talking about is this sort of caricaturish or cartoonish quality that I think is prevalent in any kind of graphic iconography, right? That it's kind of, it has to be larger than life. It's a little like TV sitcoms, too, you know, bear the same characteristics. You guys wouldn't disagree with me.
No, I think that's an issue that we also thought about. And, you know, at the risk of sounding like we're looking at all these images and trying to find problems with them, we should also say that, you know, this archive is amazing. There's some really incredible images in this collection of posters. And we were just, you know, had such a great time looking through them over and over. And thinking about them.
Yeah, it sounds like a great, a fun research assignment. I want to pot up now the audio that's serving as sort of a ground base for us so that the listeners can take a listen for a few seconds, and then we'll talk about that a little bit.
Street at San Quentin. Capital punishment means those without the capital get the punishment. Free Sundiata Akoli and all African national freedom fighters. Q. And babies? A. And babies.
You know that image?
Yes. So, Julia and David, explain to us what we were just listening to.
This is a list of slogans that we collected from all the images that we looked at. So it's about 7 pages long. The audio runs for, I think, 12 or 14 minutes. And it's played very, very low in the installation. So it's something that you have to walk up to and listen. And as you can hear, it's deliberately written and spoken in a very sort of flat monotone voice. And we are, you know, suggesting, what do these slogans mean to us now? And how do we get positioned by the sort of language that's used in these slogans?
You are not a minority. You know, you and I had spoken before we went on the air about the way in which you've treated the visual as opposed to the audio. And I wondered if you would read talk about how you're dealing with these visual images and read a little bit from an individual piece.
Mm-hmm. Well, the way we're dealing with the images is actually not to deal with the image at all. So we approach this as a task to write very descriptively about the image, but to not allow our viewers to see the image, as a way to break down what these images do to us as viewers. So I'll just read a space.
But also to sort of break down the way the image is built, mm-hmm. or the way the image is constructed, and the way that the language is also built and constructed, and how it all kind of combines together in a graphic that we present without a graphic, actually, in the piece, in the show, Democracy When. So it's sort of an analysis of an image without showing the image itself.
Yeah, and what you actually see in the installation by the Speculative Archive for Historical Clarification are a number of posters in different colors with this descriptive text on top of it, and the size or the scale of the posters have the exact scale of the original poster, but the image is withdrawn from the viewer.
Mm-hmm. So, Julia, would you read a couple of mm-hmm. lines?
Mm-hmm. This is from our category, Citizen. A large field of solid black dominates this image. Within this field of black, just above the center of the sheet on which the poster is printed, floats a medium-sized equilateral triangle. The triangle is pointing straight upwards. It is hot pink.
Okay, I think we all get what that image is. Are they all that easy to... I mean, once you describe them, are they that easy to place?
No, that's probably the most recognizable one. And some are actually quite obscure, and we we tried to choose ones that might have fairly wide circulation or wide recognizability, but it wasn't always possible. And we also wanted to choose images that we really like visually and kind of conceptually and politically, rather than picking on ones that might be more easy to pick on in terms of, you know, because frankly, there's a lot of not very interesting graphics produced in left politics. So,
a lot.
But we picked ones that we felt were really strong, compelling, interesting, and visually kind of challenging.
I want to pick up on a point that you mentioned just a minute or so ago about what these images and slogans mean today. Clearly, your strategy is to try and break the sort of resonance that have established between these images and audiences. Before I do that, let me just remind people that you're listening to Deadline LA on KPFK 90.7 FM. In Los Angeles County, 98.7 in Santa Barbara County. I'm Barbara Osborne. And I'm talking today with three people involved in an exhibition that will open Saturday, May 4th at LA Contemporary Exhibitions in Hollywood. The show is called Democracy When, Activists Strategizing in Los Angeles. I'm joined by Tuna O. Nielsen, the co-curator of this exhibition, and Julia Meltzer and David Thorne. They're the coordinators of the Speculative Archive for Historical Clarification. It is the audio that you can hear underneath the show that is part of their piece that will be in this exhibit that opens tomorrow, Saturday. There are a whole host of associated programs and events associated with the exhibition, and Tuna will ask you in a moment to kind of talk to us about some of those events. But Julia and David, let me follow up on that question about, I mean, what do you think these, clearly you're trying to find some way to break the emotional connection, our emotional connection to these images. What do you think these slogans ultimately and graphics mean today?
I think maybe I would characterize it a little differently, and rather than saying that we're trying to break an emotional connection, I would say that we want to just question what the function of an emotional connection is, or what the resonances of it are, what the different potentials, types of attachments there might be to these images. And like you mentioned at the outset, you know, we sort of approach these things with either kind of embarrassment or a kind of nostalgia, but I would also say that, you know, it's possible to look at these images as historical documents that can continue to inspire in some way just by virtue of the way that they chronicle resistances over time.
But what we want to question is, I think, an overdetermined attachment to these images and thus to political positions and political action, right?
So, yeah. Okay, so let me try and translate that. So what you're saying is these images have an emotional power of us that's been accrued over decades at least, and that the images suggest certain political positions, or sort of knit us into certain political positions that may not actually be terribly vital or useful.
Or viable, yeah.
In politics in 2002.
Like, is the only way to be a rebel, to be a mass rebel, to be a Che Guevara, you know? Is that what we strive for? You say, let's be a rebel, you know? Okay, we have Huey Newton, we have Che, you know?
Yeah. You know, I was thinking as I was preparing the show that it was interesting that the iconography that has survived, the 60s iconography that survived, has largely been the iconography that's very serious, that's very severe. And some of the, I think, really interesting political action that the Diggers were involved in, that stuff is sort of has not been reappropriated, which I just thought was an interesting observation. Tuna O. Nielsen, let's bring you into this conversation more actively. This exhibit was clearly pulled together to demonstrate a range of activist strategies. Julie and David are clearly involved in a kind of questioning and interrogation of probably some of the strategies that, in fact, are incorporated in the show. I wondered if you would talk about, not so much I want to distinguish between kind of on-the-ground political strategies and the iconography, because it's really the iconography and the rhetoric that I'm most interested in. What are some of the various iconographic strategies that you're seeing used by the kind of really range of people and groups that you've incorporated into this exhibition?
Well, I think the speculative archives revisiting of historical material and sort of dealing with the burden of the language of the left is very much an underlying tone of the entire exhibition. A number of the participants are all rethinking or trying to revisit and thereby reformulate leftist language, leftist iconography and strategies, and the show as such is really asking the question, how can you produce or affect social change? What kinds of strategies are developed in light of globalization and a political geography that we have today, which is considerably different from the 60s to revisit a historical moment that was significant and which for my generation, born in 1967, is a historical moment that I was never able to experience physically, but a moment that I've been burdened with and that I long for and that I can't really revisit on a one-to-one level because so much has changed. So I think for the majority of the participants in the exhibition who are of my generation, this historical moment has become a burden and has to be rethought in light of what is happening today.
Can I just ask you to elaborate a little bit, because I thought it was so interesting what you just said about both longing for and being burdened by. Would you talk about that a little bit?
Obviously, I think the relation you have to the resistance of the past is different depending on who you are and what community you belong to, what privilege you have been born with, and so forth. On a subjective level, speaking to myself, I'm split between being completely fascinated by this true moment of social change that 68 symbolizes. And on the other hand, it's kind of utopian romanticism that seems impossible. And I think a lot of audiences, a lot of publics agree with me or sort of share the same feeling that the world system we have today of huge corporations dominating the flow of labor, commodity, finance, and so forth are completely unaffected by 100 people gathering in a square with puppets and banners and posters on a stick. On the other hand, this is something that I still want to, I long for that to still be effective. And I think the exhibition that we're putting together, Democracy When Activists Strategizing, is revisiting all these languages, all these tropes that Julia was speaking about earlier, and sort of asking the questions why these means are not effective any longer, and bringing in people who are seriously thinking about how we can move ahead in a different way. Los Angeles Independent Media Center is part of the project, and a very, very good example of an organization that has infiltrated media in a very aggressive and critical response to the corporatization and censorship of media in this country and globally as well. Coalition Against Police Abuse and Communities in Support of the Gang Truce are also part of the project and, to me, represent organizations that have been working for a long period of time and have been able to sort of revitalize themselves, not only offering support to family members who have children inside jails, but also running these amazing programs for youth and their parents to sort of better understand the nature of police brutality, the structure of racial profiling, poverty, and discrimination. And the hope is that by bringing all these groups together and displaying what kinds of products that they're coming up with, along with a series of discussions that are happening throughout the show, that we can create this forum where we self-reflexively look at what strategies are effective in light of this globalized moment.
Yeah, it sounds like you're trying to create an opportunity where groups who are working on a variety of political issues can try and resist the ossification that happens when you build something over time and sort of assess, come up with new strategies or assess whether the old strategies are working and create new iconography and new rhetoric.
Exactly. And this is not to criticize what groups and communities and organizations have been doing in the past and what they're doing presently, but sort of acknowledging that the geography of the world right now is so complicated and corporations are so cleverly structured that there are wonderful strategizing happening, but there are also flaws within strategizing in our part of the world that needs to be rethought. And a number of the participants in the show are actually pointing to the Zapatistas and the student movement in North Korea as example of developing countries and their strategies. That's something that the West could actually learn from.
We have only a minute or so left in the segment. I wondered if you would take that time to give us the particulars. Where is this exhibition? When is it opening? There's an array of events. Maybe you can give us the website. It'll go up on KPFK's website so you can link, because I've been very impressed by everything else that's going on around the exhibit.
Yeah, very quickly, I think what is amazing about this exhibit, which has been produced by me and the participants in close, close collaboration, is that it not only exhibits what we call activist art, but that it brings in other practices from the political and social field. So it's not an art exhibition in the classical sense. It displays projects that you can visually look at inside the exhibition space, and then it has a series of events and ongoing projects that happens throughout the 6 week. So this is really an opportunity for our audience to revisit the space on a number of occasions and sort of participate actively in this investigation of strategies within activism. So the show opens this Saturday from 3 to 5. There's presentations by the exhibition participants, and from 5 to 7, there's the real opening reception.
Address and website?
Yeah, the address is 6522 Hollywood Boulevard, right before the Chinese main Chinese theater.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
Across street is Wilcox.
Wilcox.
Yeah, Wilcox. Entrance is free. All the events are free, which is very important, and we're trying to reach as many different communities and audiences as possible. You don't need to have any sort of educational background or be well educated. This space is really for everybody, with the hope that everybody will bring their personal subjective experiences in the struggle for social change. And we have a great website, which you can find at www.artleak.org/democracywhen.
Okay, let me reiterate that information for people. The show opens tomorrow, Saturday, May 4th. There's an opening from 3 to 5 p.m. It's at LA Contemporary Exhibitions at 6522 Hollywood Boulevard. And the website for more information is www.artleak.org/democracywhen. I want to thank you all very much for joining me today.
Thank you, Barbara.
Speaking with Julia Meltzer and David Thorne. They are the coordinators of the Speculative Archive for Historical Clarification. I've also been joined by Truna O'Nielsen. She's the co-curator of this exhibition, Democracy When, Activist Strategizing in Los Angeles. In my final segment, I'm joined by Matt Welch. He's a freelance journalist. He writes for ESPN.com and Reason. He covered the Nader campaign for the Progressive Press. And he is one of the behind-the-scenes folks who have been meeting with former Mayor Reardon about starting a new paper here in Los Angeles. Matt Welch, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Barbara.
So from reports I read, this paper is doomed.
Well, a lot of the people who write reports about these types of things haven't started a newspaper in their lives. B, if they did, it was in 1963, not 2002. A lot has changed in the newspaper industry and in the possibilities that you have now with technology in the last 5 years, let alone 10 or 40 years. And there's actually been a minor and little remarked upon explosion of new daily newspapers in this country, in Philadelphia, in Boston, in Nashville, in a couple of other cities across the country. So it's not as far-fetched as it may seem.
Well, that's very interesting. I actually hadn't realized that it was I know about the New York Sun, but I didn't realize that there were other new papers in those other cities.
Yeah, there's a chain of newspapers from Sweden, actually launched by a bunch of Swedish Maoists in 1995, called the Metro Paper, which is a very interesting concept by which it's a tabloid newspaper, and it's distributed for free in the metro systems or transportation systems of major cities. And they have launched papers in 23 cities on four continents, most of which become profitable after 3 years. They launched one in Boston last year, I believe, and Philadelphia the year before, or vice versa. I forget exactly which one is which. And both expect to be profitable within 2 years. And there's a new paper in Nashville called the Nashville City Paper, or the City Pages, I forget. I think there was another one being launched up in Portland, Maine. It's a new, probably the most interesting new newspaper trend in the country, but it flies under the radar of most, you know, journalism school professors.
Matt, but the strategy for this, what I will shorthand as Reardon's newspaper, is not a free newspaper. The strategy is as a subscriber-based, pay-for-it newspaper?
The strategy is being hashed out as we speak. He has been talking to a number of people, including Ken Lane and myself. Ken Lane and myself have been working on and off on a project to start a new tabloid daily in this city for 8 years, really. You know, we first started talking about it intensively in 1995 and 1996 when we didn't even live here. And that picked up steam last year when we started the LAExaminer.com website, sort of media watch website that we do. And we started that with the idea this is going to be a springboard into something new. Before last September 11th, our talks were advancing pretty rapidly on what that was going to look like and what kind of editorial team we can assign and business side team, which we basically had assembled all the way up till around September 10th. That took a hold then when there was some press about LA Examiner in the New Times, and Reardon lost the gubernatorial bid. He contacted us and has been sharing plans and ideas. That is one model. One model is to have a tabloid daily. He's also been talking about doing a New York Observer-style weekly, and he's talked about a lot of things, to be honest. If you've ever met the guy, he's all over the map in conversations. He really likes to brainstorm out loud and such.
Matt, let me ask you something, because what you're saying raises a question for me, because Reardon has been quoted saying that he wants a paper that's more pro-LA.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you and Ken Lane prefer this kind of populist, tab-style, opinionated journalism that would seem to be at odds with boosterism, at least on the face of things. Can this marriage be saved? I mean, is there a way of reconciling this?
I think so. I mean, I don't see those two things that you just posited as being opposite in any way at all. You know, we've been in talks with the mayor for more than 10 hours, you know, just in his presence. And we're completely on the same page when it comes to this aspect. It's, you know, the LA Times looks over its shoulder at New York and Chicago to figure out how it should treat its own backyard and how it should approach its, their editorial. You find them, they think that they should be competing against the New York Times and Washington Post. There was a case, stupid little anecdote, where the New York Observer recently ran a story about how all these kids from New York are now coming out to L.A. for various reasons. They needed to find a recent transplant New Yorker who hated L.A. for balance. They found an L.A. Times reporter. There is a natural, and not to be cheesy about it, but there has been a significant civic revival in this town in the last 10 years, especially 8 years, I guess, since the Northridge quake. There's been all this new interest, new books written, vibrant organizations, the LA Conservancy and whatnot. we want to create a home for that, a natural home base for those people to see what they're doing. That doesn't mean you ignore bad news. On the contrary, you seek out the bad news and say, hey, let's fix this.
Well, Matt, I have to cut you off there because we've run out of time. I'm really hoping that I can continue to check in with you on a regular basis as this thing rolls off the press.
Yeah, I hope so, too.
All right, Matt Welch, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Barbara.
I've been talking with Matt Welch. He's a freelancer, writes for ESPN.com, Reason, the Progressive Press. He is one of the people who's regularly meeting with former Mayor Reardon about starting a